Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of January. This week, we are very pleased to bring you part two of our interview with Frances Wood and Govinda Rosling of the Pitjantjatjim Research Group on Whidbey Island as the main part of our program, which was recorded about 3 weeks ago. Our trusty sound engineer, Charlie Fleischman, is with me this week to help share current observations and events. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this an interesting call? We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. First of all, we'd like to wish you all a very happy new year. And it's the perfect time of year to remind you of a sweet tradition amongst those of us that love birds, the traditional bird of the year. The first bird that you encounter on the first day of the year becomes your totem bird for that year. And throughout the year, you focus on learning as much as you can about that bird, its habits, calls, life cycle, etc. I had to smile about how it played out for me the morning of January 1st. I wandered out first thing with my binocs, first hearing a bird winging fast and high through the sky, which was gone before I could identify it. And then next I heard this odd warbling deep in the treetops, and as I was trying to track this down, I was swarmed by about a dozen golden-crowned kinglets. They were fluttering about and twittering as if to say, "Choose us, choose us." So, I did. And what better bird to have as one symbol for the new year than those bright spirits? It's not too late to start yourselves. The morning after you hear this program, go outside and open your eyes and ears to the winged life surrounding you.
Speaking of winged life, as many of you know, the figures from the Audubon Society's 118th annual Christmas bird count are just starting to roll in from the various counts held on the Olympic Peninsula over the past couple of weeks. Bob Bokelhide, who has long been in charge of the Squim Dungeness area count, wrote into the UW's Twitter site with a few observations.
He states, held on the 18th of December, the Squim Dungeness CBC tallied 143 species this year, right about average for the last 25 years. The increase in Anna's hummingbirds continues to amaze, as all Washington birders know. The first Anna's recorded on our CBC was one lone bird in 1994, and we never recorded more than three in any year until 2006. In the last decade, their numbers increased exponentially, now over 300 this year. They are everywhere. This year, 11 separate field parties counted 10 or more hummingbirds each. At this rate of increase, Anna's hummingbirds may soon become one of our top 10 species.
One other recent arrival, Eurasian collared dove, decreased this year for the second year in a row. Some field groups commented that collared doves seemed relatively scarce this year. Could predators such as Cooper's hawks and falcons finally be making a dent in the collared dove population? This year's Cooper's hawks, merlins, and peregrine falcons all tallied above their long-term averages. This information is just to whet your appetite for a Nature Now show later this month focusing on the Christmas bird count on the Olympic Peninsula and beyond. Stay tuned.
A few weeks ago, we mentioned that Puget Sound Keeper Alliance had just started a new study to gauge the level of pollution in Puget Sound using mussels, which have been placed in test cages in various locations around our region. Our local Port Townsend Marine Science Center is one of the groups involved in a related citizen science project sponsored by the Washington Department of Fisheries and Wildlife, and they have just distributed some mussels in local test plots. Mussels are just one species used for water quality testing, but they are especially good subjects because they are filter feeders and contaminants will deposit in their tissue. The mussels will stay on site in the cages for the next 90 days, after which they will be sent to the lab to test them for toxins. The results could have long-range applications for helping scientists track the health of our ecosystem and help protect marine wildlife, from mussels to orca. And now, on to part two of our interview with Frances Wood and Govinda Rosling, who were gracious enough to join us in the studio a few weeks ago to speak about their work with the delightful pigeon guillemots of Whidbey Island. How many sites do you monitor on Whidbey Island, and how many birds are there in the study area?
This is Govinda here. Whidbey Island is home to about 25, 28 colonies. We are getting around 1,000 pigeon guillemots around Whidbey Island year after year. That's been pretty stable. It's volunteer-based, so our volunteers, they go out once a week with a pair of binoculars. Like Francis says, they just become a piece of driftwood with their back to the bluff, and it's an observational study, so they're counting how many guillemots are associated with the colony, and they are writing down the times and the fish type that the guillemot brings its prey to the chicks, which are in the burrows behind the volunteers.
But you're not banding the birds just because it's so difficult to access the breeding sites, right? And it's intrusive.
Both of those are very good points. Some of these burrows are up 100 feet high. Some of these burrows go back 5 feet into the bluff. This truly is an observational study, so we're not being intrusive and we're just kind of hanging back and letting them do their pigeon guillemot thing, and we're just quietly recording what they do.
Speaking of their pigeon guillemot thing, a friend of mine who works up in Southeast Alaska says that there are pigeon guillemots everywhere there. He was telling me about how animated their breeding behavior is, that they like do little dances and twirls and hiss and trill. What's been your experience with those behaviors? Do you record behavior, or you're mostly focusing on prey items that they bring to the burrow?
Yeah, this is Frances. The study itself is based on this set of criteria that we're looking for, this protocol that we're following. Part of the attraction, I think, of this survey for our volunteers is, as you mentioned, these are extremely entertaining birds. During the breeding season, they carry out kind of do-si-dos in the water, or kind of a leapfrog where they're going after each other and tumbling around each other, and then they will take off and fly around through the air, and all this time producing a wonderful trill sound. So they're very vocal as well as being very playful.
Do they mate for life? Do we know enough about them to know if they have stable breeding pairs?
In places where they have been banded, and there is a survey on Protection Island where they have banded the birds, a smaller number of birds there, the consensus is that they do come back to the same burrow or a neighboring burrow, and that oftentimes the birds return as mates again. I think the term bonding for life is probably a little too strict for what most birds do.
Uh-huh. I study spotted owls, and for them, it really is a strict bond. Occasionally, a pair member dies, they'll take on another mate, but usually it'll be the same pair for 12 years.
Right, and I think it's a little bit different with these colony nesting birds.
Uh-huh. That there's lots of temptation there.
Well, where, maybe so. Are we reading into this?
Is there a lot of variation in breeding colony size and where the burrows are located?
As Govinda said, we have kind of a fluctuating number of colonies, somewhere between 25 and 28 on Whidbey Island. Some of those colonies can be as small as maybe 8 to 10 birds, and then we have some colonies that have over 100 birds. They all, with a few exceptions, choose to make their burrows in the very steep erosional bluffs around the island. They will often use abandoned kingfisher burrows to use as their place where they lay their eggs. They don't create any cute little nest in there. There's no little circle of pebbles or anything. They just lay their eggs right inside the burrow. We do have some places around Whidbey where they are breeding on man-made structures. One of our long-term successful study sites is the structure that is off of the Coopville or Keystone Ferry Terminal there, there's that abandoned structure out there, and they have found little crevices near the top of that where they go in and breed. And we have a couple of other wharfs. We are pretty convinced that they also breed under the Clinton Ferry Dock and at the Langley Marina at the dock there.
Do they have to have a certain degree of non-disturbance? Areas like that where they're in a structure, can they withstand disturbing?
I would say the guillemots, it depends on the colony. There are some colonies that we have that are on a beach that doesn't have any walkers, and I'll do a survey, and I'll just cross my legs, and they will fly off. Whereas we have other beaches like Mutiny Sands that is kind of a more sandy beach and vacation homes, and people are walking on those beaches with their dogs all the time, and the guillemots, they don't even bat a bird eyelash to them. So I think they can kind of get used to people. We still want to give them as much distance as running through their colony or anything. But
yeah, and people have to be really careful with their dogs, too. That, I mean, usually their burrows are located high enough in the cliff that the dogs can't get at them, right? But I would think, I was reading some awful study where they were finding that a pet dog had a huge impact on an auklet colony. People and their dogs need to be careful sometimes.
Exactly. We try to encourage beach walkers to just proceed quickly through the guillemot breeding area and then proceed down the beach. We in no way try to monitor people and their activities on the beach, but we do try to educate. So it's so often our volunteers, people ask questions why they're sitting there on the beach, why do they have a clipboard and so forth, and they begin talking about these birds, and people that have walked the beach for years and have never really known about these amazing colonies of birds. So it's also been an aspect of our study that I think has been very successful is the way we've been able to have our volunteers educate their neighbors as appropriate or other people just to spread the word about how fun these birds are.
Yeah, that's great. They're so quick when they feed the young. There's a beach that I monitor for coasts across from Protection Island. I have seen a couple of times just a single pigeon guillemot fly in with food to the bluff and notice that there's a hole there, but they're so quick, they just dart in and are out again. If you weren't there at the right time, you would never, you'd look at that hole and go, now I wonder what lives there.
So yeah, I've had that same experience before I even started studying these birds. I watched them fly into the bluff, and I mean, my first reaction was that this bird is going to just go splat against the cliff. But of course, there was a hole there, and it just disappeared right into the hole.
What happens to the juveniles when they disperse? I've read that they emerge at night and go straight into the water. Do they just swim off and feed independently, or do the adults continue to care for them after they're fledged?
Yeah, literature states that typically the guillemots will fledge at night. However, I have seen a fledging at 9 o'clock in the morning. It's back in 2010, and I was doing a survey on the east side of the island, which is really pebbly. It's not sandy like the west side. And I heard something behind me, and I looked over, and it was a guillemot tumbled. They haven't grown their primaries yet, and they're really like fluffy and down. They've been eating a lot of fish for the last month, so they're just
kind of plump.
Big and fat, yeah. So he tumbles down, and then he beelines it out to the water. Actually, I had a video camera with me, and I recorded it.
Oh,
so
how cool.
Go to our website, pigeonguillemot.org, and we have a 10-second video or so of this kind of blurry guillemot running on the pebbles. He fell down a couple of times, and then I think I held my breath during the filming and then finally let out a gasp when he dove into the water. But basically, they're on their own. They feed themselves. We have seen juveniles kind of begging for food or maybe even palling around with the adults, but typically, once they fledge, they're on their own, and we'll maybe see them next year.
It's amazing that they would know how to feed themselves, isn't it? I mean, because they've just been fed in this dark hole for, what, 30 days? Is it usually about that long?
I would say the adults consume their own prey underwater, and the juveniles, they are still learning, and sometimes they'll come up with prey and sort of choke down that fish. But it is interesting. That instinct is there to, this is where I get food, this is safety.
Just to add to that, the juveniles after they leave the burrow, there's about a 2 or 3 week period when their wings do not support flight. So they are flightless and they are diving for food. And like Govinda said, even though as adults they will ingest their food underwater, these juveniles pop up to the surface with something odd in their mouths and they kind of try to get it down. I think Govinda has seen what crab and various different things that they've tried.
Yeah, know,
little tiny things. Yeah,
they've got this one isn't quite right.
They've tried to, had to learn by trial and error there.
Oh, that's funny. So have you seen any changes in population numbers or in behavior over the course of your study?
What's quite remarkable about our study is that that number of 1,000 population that we counted the first year of our full island survey has been consistent over 8 to 10 years. We occasionally have fluctuation in the sizes of different colonies, but somehow the birds average themselves out to keep that population of 1,000 very consistent. As far as the breeding success goes, it's been a little bit more variable. Since there are quite a few birds, probably sub-adults or maybe unmated birds or birds that haven't found a burrow, about only 30% or 40% of our birds will be breeding at any 1 year. So there are a lot of extra ones sort of palling around there. Certain colonies produce a higher number of probable breeding successes each year, but our numbers have stayed pretty consistent on that as well. Govinda, do you have some more on that?
I would say another part of our study is looking at certainly the population of the guillemot, but also what the composition of the prey is.
Uh-huh.
And there are three basic fish types that we're looking at. Gunnel, which is that long eel-like fish. Sculpin, which is more of like a spiny, bullhead, double ugly of a fish. And then we have an other category, like sometimes it's sand lance or crab. We had an intern who got a photo of a squid.
Whoa.
A couple years ago. But I would say most often it's gunnel that they are choosing to feed those chicks, followed by sculpin and then followed by other.
Uh-huh. And do they have just one chick in each burrow?
They typically will hatch two eggs, uh-huh. two chicks in each burrow.
So it doesn't change, it doesn't seem to be changing, but that's part of what the information that you collect and baseline information is you're trying to figure out how the food types might change year to year, right? But at the moment, it seems pretty steady.
Yeah, I would say for the would-be population, we're getting about 50% is gunnel with 20% with sculpin and the other 20 or 25% with other areas like South Sound. They have quite a bit more gunnel, maybe 65%. Over in Clallam County, it's around 67% of gunnel fish types, gunnel and prickleback that the guillemots are feeding to their chicks.
Uh-huh.
It does vary, and I think as we have more surveys in different areas, then we can gain a fuller picture of
what's happening. Variability depending on where the birds are feeding and living. Mm-hmm. When we spoke earlier on the phone, you were telling me some great stories of unusual things that you've observed with the birds, including some surprising burrow mates that the guillemots have had.
I was filling in for a volunteer over in Mutiny Bay one morning. I saw an orange wing in what would have been burrow number 15, and it was very surprising. I thought it was being maybe predated on, and I kind of stood up and looked around, and I couldn't peek in the burrow. It's up 30 feet, but as you walk back, you can kind of look in, and actually there were two barn owls that had taken up residence in this burrow. Quite surprising.
I know, but not with the guillemots.
Not with the guillemots.
I know.
I think they got their own burrow.
Yeah. We've also found guillemots breeding in some very unusual places as opposed to their more typical erosional bluff. There's a lot of breeding on steep, rocky cliffs and so forth. When my husband and I were up in Haida Gwaii a couple years ago, we noticed that on the ferry that connects two of the islands up there, that there were these guillemots sitting on the railing as the ferry was moving from one island to the other. And we asked one of the guys on the ferry that was helping to load the cars, and he said, oh, they breed right here underneath the loading ramp.
Wow.
And so they had found a little spot there. We also had the report from one of the other members of our team that there was a sailboat had been moored in Holmes Harbor on the east side of Whidbey Island, and that when the people owning the boat finally got around to taking it out, must have been mid-June, they realized that two little eggs were sitting right inside one of their portholes that had been left open. And evidently the guillemots had come in and saw that round porthole and thought this would be a great little cavity to lay their eggs.
Oh, opportunistic then.
Yes.
I don't suppose that they able to hatch those out, the folks.
No. These are the exception, of course.
So you've expanded your study in recent years to include some sites over in Clallam County. How many sites do you monitor on the Olympic Peninsula?
There is a new study. I think Clallam County is in their second year.
A friend of mine is helping with one of those. Yeah, Carrie Williamson is working. Is it Salt Creek?
Bachelor Rock.
That's right. She loves it. Actually, it's really fun.
Along with Bachelor Rock, there's five other colonies in Clallam County, and from Bachelor Rock to the far west to Panorama Vista at Port Williams.
You were mentioning when we last spoke how you were hoping to get some surveys started in Jefferson County.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
We're looking for some volunteers if anybody wants to join us.
All you listeners out there, actually, I would love to volunteer too. Do you have any special target areas where you'd like to get people to watch?
Well, I think we're just kind of looking for the local folks here in Port Townsend to tell us where they're seeing guillemots. You tell us where you've seen them, and we can come up with a survey.
A little training. You go through a training.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And so that people are collecting information the same way, and there's a set protocol.
Yeah, right, there
people
is.
People follow.
Yes, there is a set protocol. And if you go to our website, www.pigeonguillemot.org, our protocol is written, and you can read through it, and you can contact us, certainly, with any questions. Or if you'd like to maybe think about joining us here in Jefferson County, go to guillemotresearch@gmail.com.
Great.
To contact us.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, hopefully you'll be flooded with people wanting to start up. Their New Year's resolution in January will be, we want to study guillemots.
Just to try to sweeten the pot here a little bit and let the volunteers know a little bit more what they're in for. The volunteer studies consist of 1 hour per week on the beach. It's summer duty. We promise warm breezes and sunny skies and no fog. And hopefully a lovely sort of quiet meditative time on the beach while they're doing this survey.
And they get to see guillemots, which,
exactly.
I mean, what more reward do you need? They're just so delightful. Thanks so much for coming and sharing with us.
As our fine natural history groups begin to gear up for the new year, there is only one upcoming natural history event to tell you about. To start the new year outright, the Olympic chapter of the Audubon Society is hosting a class titled The Inside Story, which will discuss the biology and physical features of birds, how they eat, digest, breathe, sing, reproduce, and fly. Come to the Dungeness River Audubon Center on Saturday, January 6th, from 10 a.m. to noon.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a black turnstone, and they are one of our most common winter resident shorebirds, part of the very large and diverse sandpiper family. They usually arrive in late summer and stay until April, when they leave for the breeding season up in Alaska. They are a compact, short-billed bird, found primarily on rocky shores. All plumages are mostly black with white bellies. Their bellies and underwings are white, and their heads and breasts are black. And in flight, they flash a dramatic black and white chevron pattern. They're very vocal, with shrill rattles and chatter, and they often serve as sentinels for other species of shorebirds feeding along with them, the first to sound the alarm call. They are very busy birds, working in generally small groups, though sometimes gathering in flocks of 100 or more. They work up and down a rocky coast, turning over rocks with their strong bills, hence their name, looking for choice morsels. They also can be seen helping the port out with cleaning duty along the jetties of the boat haven. Our friend Rick Altman describes how he often sees them bustling about near where his boat, the Cape Clear, is moored, clearing all of the concrete seams of the walkway of moss. They should be on the payroll. Our thanks to the great birding resource, birdweb.org, and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for the recording. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the first week of the new year. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. Wishing you all a new year filled with natural delights.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Whidbey Island Blues, performed by the Seattle group The Maldives.
I fall apart. Apart from you, you said, don't worry, there's no hurry. And I had listened, and I've grown so old. Out here on my own, you can take me, but don't shake me. If you break me, I will break you. So take my advice. Take heed.